Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. It's the 3rd of November 2024, 7 o'clock in the morning. Cat is waiting to come in. I woke up last night at 5. I let the cat out. There we go. Cat was eager to go out. Now eager to come in. Aren't you, Puss? And I will feed you, but you can have a little treat, because you'll annoy me otherwise. Here we are. A little bit of, if you want. And he's very happy. I'm going to make myself a cup of coffee this morning. I hope you are all well. I shall go and have a look at the diarist shortly. Sorry. I'll try not to be too meandering as I was yesterday. But you know what these audio things are. It's a snippet of life. It's a snippet of life. It's the morning of a chap doddering around. You all right, Puss? Did you have a nice time? I had a very lovely, I made up last night, a very lovely chicken and vegetable broth. It's that time of year now, isn't it? I think broths are here now. Casseroles, mind you, we have casseroles all year round. Porridge. Porridge. I may make some porridge. That reminds me. Have I got enough milk? I'm not sure. I need to get another raw milk out the freezer. So let's make this. I've been watching a chap. Can't remember if I told you yesterday. He's a pipe maker somewhere in France. And he's on YouTube. Course. He's an interesting, very interesting chap. And sorry, I'm on the other side of the kitchen. Just getting another. I always wish I had bought more raw milk when I go to the farm shop. He's a very interesting bloke. His name, I think, is Chris. I may talk about him in a video I may do today. He's in France somewhere, and he's got a little crazy-looking little workshop, you know, a bit dilapidated. It looks brilliant, really. Something one could really get one's teeth into, making it look very nice, but humble, 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 humble. Sorry about the sniffling. Anyway, he makes the... He's not been doing it terribly long, only about 4 years or something, but he makes the most delightful pipes. They are gorgeous. There seems to be now a resurgence of pipe smoking and pipe making, and I'm absolutely thrilled. I'm just hoping that there is a similar resurgence for pipe tobacco, but good, honest, organic, healthy, you know. It is healthy. I don't know why I halted on that. Unsprayed, I suppose, is what I meant. Not grown with pesticides and things like that. Got the sniffles this morning, only because I have literally only woken up and staggered downstairs. Thought, well, I'll just do... You are my first thoughts, gentle listener, sitting there by the fireside. I finished this tin. I was close to the end yesterday. I thought, well, I must finish it. Of my guilty pleasure... Tobacco by Ashton. It would be, there's some all sorts of lovely tobaccos from different places in the world. It would be lovely to be able to source some of those. But trying to get them in from America is huge taxes on them, which is a real pain. I don't know how else you would do it unless you're
buying significant bulk, or you didn't declare what it is, I suppose. But I think the places that sell them, the shops, they have to declare them, otherwise the authorities go down them on a ton of, or like a ton of bricks, etc. But yes, what was I was going to do something. Something occurred to me. I was going to do something. I can't remember what it is. Anyway, I should just put my coffee down and find our book. Oh yes, I was going to turn the internet on. That was what I was going to do. I'll do that in a minute. Just means so that when I turn the computer on, I can access it. So the third, Gilbert White in 1777, Hampshire. Seagulls, winter mews haunt the fallows. I can tell you the weather outside is overcast. White, grey. It's not wet. It doesn't seem to be cold, just grey. We're having a lot of grey. A lot of this is manipulated. Some of it may be natural, but it's just not very nice. November should be sunny, chilly, crisp, and beautiful and stunning with the leaves and the colours. But it doesn't seem to be. Francis Kilvert in 1874 in Wiltshire says the strange hoarse belling of the buck, the fluttering of the coot as she skimmed the water with her melancholy note, the cry of the swans across the lake, the clicking of the reels as the fishermen wound up or let out their lines, the soft murmur of the woods, the quiet rustle of the red and golden drifts of beech leaves, the rush of the waterfall, the light tread of the dappled herd of deer, dark and dim, glancing across the green glades from the shadow into sunlight and rustling under the beeches, and the merry voices of the marquis's children at play. What about them? I always get a bit funny when it's sentences don't really do anything. Just says the this, the that, the other, and the thing. And what about them? Yeah. It's like when people say, and I've seen it, and it really bugs me. I don't know why it gets under my. And they say, I don't know, swarms of bees bashing against a window. That what? That it, I mean, qualify it. It feels like that. It looks like that. It sounds like that. That is what's happening around. Not just that. Goodness sake. Richard Jefferies in 1878 in Surrey said on this day, it's quite nice when you've got a few of them and they're beautifully written. Having just criticised it. Because you do get a idea of what it was like if it's a little bit more detail rather than one-liners. Richard Jefferies in 1878 in Surrey says the horse chestnut buds at the end of boughs. Oh, here we go. He's not doing the same, is he? The horse chestnut buds at the end of boughs, tree quite bare of leaves, all sticky, colour of deep varnish. Still day, the earth holds its breath. The chestnut buds at the end of the boughs, tree quite bare of leaves, all sticky, covered in deep varnish. Are you suggesting that? No, it can't well be. I mean, he's saying that's today, isn't it? That the buds, I didn't think the buds would be out, would they? For next year. I know that they do look like that, but I thought the chestnuts would be full and about to burst onto the ground. Is this not chestnut season? Or have we had it? Who knows? I'm trying to think then. We always have chestnuts at Christmas, don't we? Which makes one feel that the chestnuts have just burst. But of course, they must have burst earlier in the year. and the conkers and things. And of course they did. Of course they did. They would have been bursting much earlier in the year, in the harvest time, and hey-ho.
Right.
I need to go and blow my nose, turn the internet on, have another slurp of coffee, and continue with this diatribe that I put out. I think I'll put the internet on first. I went for a walk yesterday down to the seafront, and as I was walking down, I passed this wretched company who are digging up the ground and putting in these the underground heating. They're called Hemico, and they claim they're going to be there, you know, to save us money on our heats. And anyway, the signage said, "Good news, we've completed the first stage of our operation to save Worthing millions of tons of H2O. And I thought to myself, "You bastards, we need that H2O. Anyway, there was a chap, I feel much better having blown my hooter. There was a chap walking his dog, I think his name was Ross, and he said, "Hello, Mr. Famous Man." I said, "Hello." He said, "Yes, I watch you on YouTube." I said, "Oh, okay, thank you very much, that's very kind." He said, I said to him, "I've just been reading these, this bollocks here about the CO2, you know, just to get a measure of what it was like." And he said, "Oh yes, it's a load of old bollocks, isn't it?" Anyway, I knew, as soon as he said that, we were going to get on like a house on fire. And we did. We walked down past the hospital, across. He said, "Which way are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm just going down to the seafront, really, to go and just stretch my legs. I've been in the house all day, working away on various things." He said, "Oh, well, I'm going down across the park." I said, "Yes, that's exactly where I'm going." Oh, I said, "Oh, we'll walk together." So we strolled together with his big dog, big white fluffy thing. Very nice chap. And he told me all sorts of things. He did tell me that Beach House, which is this Georgian house opposite the beach, set back from the beach, near where Peter Pan used to be. And there used to be a paddling pool, a very popular paddling pool. Anyway, I mentioned that and he said, "Oh yes." I said, "I remember that." And I said, "Well, I used to take my kids there." I said, "Now they put these stupid pebble things." He didn't like that either. And I said, "You know, you get like 10 or 20 at the tops." I said, "In the paddling pool, you'd have 500 kids screaming and jumping, laughing, having fun." I said, they've ruined Worthing. Well, they have ruined it. Anyway, he told me in Beach House, this Georgian house, which I thought was just offices for the council, it's all residential. And there's some beautiful flats in there. I thought, I'm not surprised. He had one of them at one point. I said, "Wow." He said, "Yes, it was lovely. I was right at the top and you had this beautiful view down to the beach." He said, "I saw them cut down part of I suppose it was built in the 60s. In the 60s, there was built a series of beach huts, but they weren't as in huts, as in wooden huts. They were concrete huts or cabins, I suppose, with a walkway on the top. And they've cut through, they've knocked some of the huts down, they've cut through the walkway. So it looks like there ought to be a bridge across this, like a motorway that has yet to be finished, you know, but up in the air, like a bridge that has got the two ends. Underneath one end is a cafe and underneath the other is a sort of water sports shop that does paddleboarding and things. And actually he said he works there. He said, "Oh, you must come out on the sea and do some paddle boarding." I said, "You know, I'd love to do that." I said, I did have a kayak, but and I still got the kayak, actually. I don't know what to do with the bloody thing." Excuse me. Ed Shu, are you here? And I said, "The trouble is, you see..." Ed Shu, are you there? When I lost my eye, I have acrylic. I have an acrylic eye. It's shell-shaped. I said the thing is, if you do the thing that kayaks can do, and that is turn 180 degrees very rapidly, and you swim out of the thing, I said chances are my eye would, my false eye would just wash out because of the pressure of the water, that sudden blast, which is one reason I really don't go swimming anymore. Plus the sea is filthy. Anyway, I said, you know, I know people say, oh, you could wear goggles. He said, well, you could wear an eye patch. I said, yeah, I suppose I could. But that's not really the same. Plus, of course, I'm short-sighted and I don't wear contact lenses anymore. So I would lose my glasses and all of this sort of thing. And I think it would be nicer to be in a slightly more substantial boat that generally doesn't flip over. I think, you know, if you're all right with your eyes, it's different. But anyway, I've got this. It's a plastic one. It's a big, long plastic one. It's just sitting there. I don't know what to do with it. I'd give it away to somebody if they actually did a bit of kayaking. Anyway, I kept it because I thought one day, sometime, I might go up and down rivers as the bald explorer. And but because on a kayak, on a river, you know, you can really get some speed up, or you can make, and of course you can just pick it up and walk around the locks more than you can with the coracle that I've got, but it's now mouldy. It's now it's in no shape whatsoever, really. It is falling to bits. I mean, it needs to be smashed up and burnt. It did well. I'm just living down here on the coast. You just don't get very many opportunities, and it's quite a bulky thing to have taken. And really and truly, as it was a lovely museum piece. And if I had a big enough set, I would put it in the set. But it looks ridiculous. It would actually, it's too bulky, but it would have made quite a nice bookcase, actually, thinking about it. And if one could slice it in half, you could still make it into a bookcase. You'd have to reinforce it with things. But anyway, it's a shame. It is a shame. But there you go. Anyway, so we had a good old chin chat about various things. And he said, would you like a beer? And I said, well, that's very kind. Yes, I would like that very much. So we went into Coast Cafe. I had a beer. I did look to see if they had any, you know, local ales, but they just had a commercial ale in it. So I just had half. That was enough. It wasn't particularly nice. But I wasn't going to have lager, although I dare say this thing wasn't really ale at all. I don't know what it was. And we had a bit more of a chat, and then that was it. We went our ways. He said, well, you never know, might see you again. I said, yes, I'd take a walk. And that was it. It was very nice to have met someone, have a chat, you know. People don't do that so much these days, do you? Just meet a random stranger and go for a beer. I know it sounds a bit weird, but of course he knew who I was. And that's the thing that most people come up and they say, you know, we know who you are, but you don't know anything about us. I said, no, I know. That's the story of my life. And of course, this is very much what happens to very famous people, not idiots like me. But it is very nice when people do recognise you in that way. And in real life, the people who like you or have seen you or can tolerate you will come up and talk to you if they do anything. Online, the same will happen. But also the trolls and the people who want to throw abuse. And they do it online because they don't do it in real life. Isn't that funny? That is why the comments really, you know, don't read them, because it can bring you down, because there's a lot of people who would not say these things to your face. And in a way, the comments, people are welcome to write what they like in the comments, but unless you've got a thick skin, just don't look at them. And that's what I would say. It's very rare, for example, to get an email from somebody who doesn't like you. It does happen. It does happen. But it's rare. It's rare. Once, you know, once every 6 months or something, somebody will send something. I mean, you get people correcting you. That's different. That's very different. But it is rare that somebody will just send abuse, perhaps twice a year, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm usually very charming back to them if I can be bothered. And on one occasion, I've invited people onto the show and said, well, you know, you clearly don't like what I'm doing. You clearly think I'm wrong. You clearly find me obnoxious to watch. Can't understand why you do, therefore, watch. But if you're very welcome to come on the show and tell me why. And then, of course, you don't hear from them. If people resort to calling names, they have no argument. And that does seem to be the very much the case. Does seem to be very much the case. Now, we've got a few minutes left on this podcast. Now, I want to go back in time to another dimension. I want to go back to this book, The Vision of Glory, The Extraordinary Nature of the Ordinary. I haven't had a chance to sort of read any more because I've got other books I've been trying to read. And so I'm just opening this up much deeper than we went in. And this is chapter 3, sections from The Work of Rivers. I'm not quite sure what he means by that because I haven't... maybe this is chapter 3 on another section of the book. The Arrival of Plants, it says. We must now come to the surface. Oh, maybe he's been talking about life underneath the surface. Let's just get an idea of what he's on about. We have witnessed the work of water underground. We have seen how it is held in reserve and perennially emerges in the form of springs and can be tapped by wells. And then there's a star here that says, not included in this volume. Oh, thanks. That you can be tapped by wells, I suppose. We have entered the territories which is created in the mountains, but it is cold and flowerless land in which nothing living can be nourished, save a few blind insects in the desolate pools. No fish could live in those lightless lakes, as no bird could sing in those shades. Only the poor little bats, shrinking and fearful, might find home. Well, I don't know that bats are shrinking and fearful. They might shrink. How different it is above ground. There we see that water, accompanied by light and warmth, is the giver of light, of life. I beg your pardon. At the beginning of the last chapter, I recalled the time when the earth consisted of only fire and rock. The main fact to be realised about rock is so big and so simple that we are inclined to overlook it. Namely, it is our chief food. That's a very good point. If living things were to exist, they could only do so by eating rocks. There was nothing else for them to eat. And that is just what rocks were and are, food which has been and still eaten daily. I do not speak figuratively. True, they are not chewed off and eaten like bread or grass, or when they have become what we might call stone flour, are they taken neat. But their mineral properties, their juices, as it were, have been the basic food of everything. And to this day, if we go into a chemist's shop to buy a tonic, we will find on the label a list of rock properties to encourage further purchase. Well, think of mineral water. How are the rocks prepared as food? Where are the mills for grinding the stone into flour? Again, we must answer that this is the work of the raindrop, and it still is. We seek this work as having been accomplished in two great movements, one belonging to the past, the other still going on. The first was when the hydrosphere, which was held aloft in the atmosphere, fell down upon burning rocks. This meant tremendous chemical combustion, erosion, pulverization, so that the first sea was a strange sea indeed, whose waters, boiling hot and thickened with mud and slime of all sorts, formed a kind of mineral, pea soup, shrouded in the chaos of steaming vapours. That's a nice phrase, and I think he says that comes from H. Faber, This Earth of Ours, as a quote. This mineral pea soup, this sediment, in due course sank to the bottom, solidified, and became sedimentary rocks. As the eons rolled by, continents under the influence of the volcanicity rose from the sea, and the sedimentary rocks became part of dry land, leaving traces to this day upon some of the highest mountains. Yet, and this is what I feel bound to emphasise, this sediment did not necessarily always and everywhere come up hard. It may have come up soft, and thus formed the basis for the first soils of the world. Now, this is interesting. I just want to point out, this is an interesting thing. There's a chap who I have had on the show. He came to my house to be on the show, and I offered him a drink. And he said, I have some water, please. And I said, oh. And I gave him some filtered water. A reverse osmosis, I think. And I said, do you want some Celtic sea salt in it? And his attitude was, what? Why would you want to pollute it? I want the water as pure as possible. I said, yes, but it's basically got nothing in it at all now. It's just two chemicals, H2O, hydrogen and oxygen. And he said, well, why would you want to pollute it with all the other stuff? And I thought that's a strange attitude. I didn't push it, because the point of adding salt, Celtic sea salt, Himalayan pink salt, is that you're adding minerals to it, very important for the body. And I just thought, well, you misunderstood this. You've misunderstood the point. And he said, no, I want it in its most natural form. Well, water in its most natural form that is of any use to the human body, man and women, would in its natural form land. I mean, unless you've got your mouth agog in the sky, you're not catching rainwater in that fashion. It would land, seep through the ground, and be mineralised by travelling through the aquifers, through the underground passages. It would run across rocks, and as it says in the raindrop, it would gather minerals. And he's quite right, that is what we eat. The food is is the minerals that our body needs. And this is an absolute relevant and fascinating thing. And that would be what life would have sprung from, at the springs where the water comes out in its cleanest and most natural, but mineralised, filtered and all of that, but mineralised, reinvigorated, full of structure. And so I found that attitude a bit weird, that he wouldn't want to do that. He thought it was polluting the water. Polluting the water is adding coffee and milk and various other things to it, of course, to form a flavoursome drink, which may, depending on the type of coffee that you have a caffeine thing that might be addictive. It might add certain things or take certain things away from you, whatever whatever it is. I find that very strange. So that was an interesting thing. But this is, again, I have a book here called Paramagnetism. And it says in there, to grow plants, to get back to having plants. Plants need minerals. We've depleted the soil of the minerals because we've poisoned the animals. We've poisoned all the nature of the soil. The wind has blown and eroded it away. We've been digging it and mucking about with it in the farming, in the industrial farming. We need mixed farming. And one of the things to get plants to grow is to cover it in minerals, as fresh minerals as possible. Volcanic, if you can get it. Certain types of minerals better than others, because that's what the plants need to feed. They turn those, they get the minerals through the water that run The water that runs over those minerals and takes the water into the plant, and what with photosynthesis, you end up with plants which are bigger and more bountiful and abundant and beautiful. It's very basic stuff, really, but it is we've forgotten it, and we feel that we have to have these artificial chemicals and things in order to survive. What did we do before these artificial chemicals in the last 50 to 80 years, one may ask? Well, we survived abundantly, thank you very much, and we weren't so bloody ill. I know the time is ticking, I'll read a little bit more of this. I don't find this fascinating. I just want more time to read and digest. That is what I would call the first movement of the raindrop, for turning rocks into soil. The second movement began when the land blocks and the sea blocks had sorted themselves out, and the earth consisted of dry land, as yet uninhabited by organic life. There was no sand, which I have called the stone floor, save what had been supplied by the sediment caused by the first great invasion of water from the skies. The second movement saw, by means of frost chiselling and ice prising and glacier work, and direct acid action of the raindrop, and the sheer power of torrents brought about the denudation and degradation of the rocks. This was the second great movement. The cold mountains were exposed to the assault of water. It was, and is, for it still goes on, a battle which the mountains are passive and cannot throw back the assailant as fire did. The victory must go to the water. As flake by flake and stone by stone and rock by rock and avalanche by avalanche, the mountains are brought low and turned into soil. Thus today, every meadow and prairie, every valley and plain, every farm and homestead, every city throughout the world rests upon the foundation of ruined rocks. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't that so important for farmers, for us as living beings, to live and thrive on the food that comes? This, you know, this is the basics of life. We realise, of course, that rocks, however much they are ground into sand, are not in themselves soil. They are not loam, not vegetable mould. But they made vegetable mould possible. They served as the foundation for it. At one time, the moist chip rocks formed the basis for the first plant. Do not ask me how the first plant arrived, or the first animal. Do not ask me how the first organic form entered the lithosphere, or the hydrosphere, or the atmosphere, for I have no idea. I assume that inorganic life is really organic, and that the latter grew out of it, so that there is no real gulf between the dance of the magnets in the molecules and the dancers at Sadler's Wells. I would say, with Kieseling, or Kieseling, the music of the universe slumbers in the irrational laws of crystallization. All artistic ideas are symbolically preconceived in the germ of the plasma. For the first breath of desire, which trembled through the shapeless chaos and unbroken chain of development, leads to the Iliad and to the Parthenon. Anyway, they did arrive, and the miracle of their arrival should silence the bewildered gentlemen who seem to think that the means of survival is of religious import. And having done so, they gave themselves up to the further creation of the soil. The great work is begun, by which the ashes of dead vegetation and the dead animals became the life-giving basis for future growth. And that... I must continue to read that book. I love it. It's very poetic, but it is, of course, based on truth and just useful stuff. Anyway, I have waffled on for some time. I apologise. It's a Sunday. Why not? It's probably half past seven now. I will leave you to your day. I hope it's been a better one than before. And there you go. It's great to have these thoughts entering one's mind as you enter the day. Certainly from my perspective, anyway. You may be going, oh my God, I wish I'd turned that bloody idiot off. But fair enough, you can do that now. Or you could have done it before, of course. You are in control of your own destiny. It's not for me to have any bearing on it whatsoever. If I have entertained, amused, educated, I don't know, done something to made you smile, if there's been the slightest limp, rising of the mouth into a smile, the slight chuckling in the background as you've been listening to this, and someone's looked up at you and gone, what the hell is he listening to, or she? Have a good day, my friends. Bye-bye.